And I had this serious, I'm not worthy issue that retained was up here. And I didn't see myself here. And that's an inner perception that I think many of us struggle with, especially people who want to go from contingency to retain. It's like, yeah. Why all of a sudden am I good enough to do retain? What solved that problem for me was understanding not what was changing in me, but what was changing in the service that I was providing.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Carol Wenham.
The number one thing for me is really look at what your specialty niche is. If you cannot become a market master and dominate your niche, then your niche is too big.
Carol is a recruitment industry veteran with over 40 years experience specializing in engineering and technical search for the refining and chemical process industries. She spent 35 years at the Whitaker Companies, where she served as vice president and general manager. She was a consistent top producer in their engineering division.
There is nothing that replaces picking up the phone and talking to somebody and having that conversation and closing and building relationships. What has changed is how you do all of that. The tools in the toolbox have changed significantly. When I first started back in the Stone Age, cut and paste literally was something you did with scissors and glue.
Throughout her career, Carol earned preferred provider status with major clients. She also held leadership roles with national industry associations and received multiple awards, including induction into the NAPS Hall of Fame. She's a past president and lifetime member of the Pinnacle Society, and she's spoken extensively across the United States and Canada on recruiting best practices.
If your focus is business development, 2/3 of your day needs to be spent doing business development. And okay. For me, business development means like 25% doing passive business development, like newsletters and all of that. And 75% means making live calls.
Carol, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
And so we've met a couple of times at Pinnacle Society conferences. I think the last time was in Atlanta in October. Does that sound right?
That sounds right.
All right. Awesome. Look, your career spans more than 4 decades, which is hard to believe.
Right. I started when I was 12, of course.
Exactly. Absolutely. So what do you think has changed the most, and also what has stayed the same in recruitment since you started?
Everything has changed in so many ways. It's easier to talk about what stayed the same, and then I'll flip to what has actually changed.
Great.
So what has stayed the same is the personal connection. There is nothing that replaces picking up the phone and talking to somebody and having that conversation and closing and building relationships. Recruiting is recruiting. Marketing is marketing. Now, what has changed is how you do all of that. The tools in the toolbox have changed significantly. When I first started back in the Stone Age, cut and paste literally was something you did with scissors and glue. And honestly, I mean, this is seriously dating me, but I remember when we were excited to get a fax machine, and it was so expensive to fax that the person had to be standing on the other end waiting to get it to justify sending a fax. And it literally took days because to get feedback on a resume, because resumes went snail mail.
Yeah, in the mail, that's right. Right.
And so, you know, now the luxury of having feedback in nanoseconds. I mean, you know, being able to real time have conversations with your client while you're both reading the same resume electronically that you prepared electronically, that your candidate sent to you electronically. I mean, all of that is different. We literally used Rolodex cards. I mean, most people don't know what that is. And it's really funny because when I used to do my email blasts, I was rainmaker for a team of recruiters. And one of my favorite spiel lines was, you know, let me go through my mental Rolodex and see who I have available. And at one point, one of my recruiters turned to me and said, "What's a Rolodex, Carol?"
Right.
And I was like, oh, yeah. Right. Okay. But literally, you know, we had like punch cards and memory cards and yellow pages and directories and bound books. And And that's how we found our companies, and that's how we found our candidates. And I remember when I first started, I was with a group called Scientific Placement, and they were one of the very first companies, they were based in Houston, that had a computerized candidate database system. And it took up an entire room. The computer did.
Hilarious.
It was amazing. And we were very state of the art back then. And so literally from a technology standpoint, everything has changed. Response time, interaction time. I mean, the whole spectrum of how you find candidates, how you promote yourself in the marketplace, literally all of that has changed. So all the tools in the toolbox have changed in many, many, many ways. But what I find fascinating, and this is what I focus on a lot in my training, is that it doesn't really matter what tools are in your toolbox. In the end, it comes down to your personal relationship between you and your candidate and you and your client and the service that you're delivering. And it's true that all of the tools in your toolbox can help you do that more effectively and more efficiently, but nothing replaces that personal relationship.
I agree 100%. And I guess that is the one part that is never going to be replaced by an AI agent, right? It's that relationship piece. So speaking of that, then, you were a preferred supplier to numerous top clients. What strategies or mindset shifts were critical for you to achieve that?
It was all about deepening the relationship with the clients. When I started with many of my clients, I was a contingency recruiter, and we worked everything. And we worked with HR, we worked with hiring managers. I mean, we worked with anybody and everybody. And we did a lot of one-off placements. Like we had, you know, however many clients we had, it was a lot of them. And we worked one of everything for everybody. And it was great. I mean, it was effective in that it got our name established in the marketplace. And my niche is literally a minute and a half long. I mean, it's a really weird, very finite niche. And over the years, unfortunately, the niche grew smaller because we went through a lot of mergers and acquisitions. So actually, my client base shrunk instead of getting bigger. But it did allow us to, those one-offs and contingency allowed us to get established and become known in the industry. And that was great. But I realized that I was scrambling and spending a lot of time and not making a lot of money, or not making as much money as I wanted to be making doing what I was doing. And as with all good ideas that I've had in my late career, I went to my folks at the Pinnacle Society and said, okay, what am I doing differently that you guys are making twice as much money as I am? And got a lot of input, switched over to the Rainmaker model because I was doing a 360 desk and I just couldn't be everywhere doing everything all the time. Quickly realized that my passion and my real strength is in the business development and client development side. And so I brought on a team of recruiters to support my recruiting efforts and train them all myself. And then we switched to a blended model. We did contingency, we did engaged and retained. And I pitched the entire suite to my clients, which is a little bit different. I know not everybody does that. And in order to do that, you have to get clear in your own mind what you believe the difference in your service is between retained, engaged, and contingency. And I am a believer that there is no one size that fits all. For some clients, contingency is the way they want to go, and that's fine. For other clients, retained makes all the sense in the world. Our failing, I think, as recruiters is that we don't spend enough time educating our clients about the difference in what we do between retained, engaged, and contingency. And it, in simplistic terms, comes down to, if you want to buy my time and undivided attention, then we will go retained. If you don't need my undivided attention and my speed and my entire team, then we can talk about engaged or contingency if that's better for you. But understand that I will prioritize your search based on your priority of requirements of my time needs. And it was very interesting because when I started to understand my value prop about retained versus engaged versus contingency, I never said, I'm not going to do contingency. And I never said, I'm not going to do engaged. But when I started explaining the value proposition to my clients, it worked to my advantage that I had 20 plus, 25 plus, 30 plus years in that specialty niche. And nobody, literally nobody in my niche had that length of experience. And so when I explained that value prop of they were buying me specifically and my time and my industry knowledge, as opposed to the rest of my team and they're doing recruiting, et cetera, all of a sudden, like people started elevating to engaged and retained service. And we still did a small percentage of contingency search. And my clients understood that it was my team and not me that was doing the recruiting on the contingency searches. And if that wasn't working well, we could change to an engaged or retained model, but we could start at contingency and see how they felt about it. And like it was a world shift in my market. Like 90% of my market just became engaged and retained, not because I insisted on it, but because I educated them about the value prop of what they were getting for the money.
This is brilliant, Carol. I love that we're going into this because it was one of the topics I had planned to ask you about. So, by the way, you've thrown out a few terms here. Value prop is short for value proposition,
Right. Which
yeah, that's all right. I just want to make, because not everyone's familiar with the same terminology. And so that's essentially your solution, the value that you're bringing, the unique value you're bringing to your client that differentiates you from others in the market. So there's a lot to unpack here, and there's a few things I want to follow up on. But let's just stick with the shift from contingent to retained for a moment, because I think this is so important. That look, I actually had a coaching call with my clients yesterday, and we talked about the fact that. Yeah. So one of our clients is a big biller, but he's contingent and he's filling about 1 in 3 of the mandates that he's working on. Right. So, and he's already working as hard as he wants to work. So now the question is, how do we increase your billings without working more? And you've only got a few options here, right? You can get more top of funnel. So get more jobs on. Or you can convert a higher percentage of the jobs you've already got and plug some of the leaks in your bucket, or you can increase the average value of each placement. Those are three avenues that you have to increase your billings. Now, which of those is in my view, the best one to start with? It's let's increase the fill rate because it doesn't require any more work. That's the thing. You're not working longer hours, but the number one best way to achieve that is to get more of your clients on an engaged or retained basis. Because when you're working that way, you know, there's no guarantees in recruitment, right? There's always things that can go wrong, but it's the most likely way to make sure that you get paid for your work. You said something that I love, which is, that you educated your clients on the difference between contingency, engaged, and retained. And you used a phrase I really like, which is that essentially they're buying your priority time. And that's a phrase I've used myself. I think clients don't understand that until you explain it to them.
Right.
I'm wondering if you could just give a little more detail around because before you try and explain this to a client, you need to be clear in your own mind, right, of what is the difference. So in your view, if you take these three service offerings, you've got the contingency, you've got engage, which means they're paying you a deposit, and then the balance, and then a full retained search, which is typically a third, a third, a third, although it could be some other percentage. You've already highlighted one key distinction, which is that if the client is retaining you, they get prioritized, right? You're putting whatever time and resources are required into that in order to make sure that you deliver. What are some of the other key distinctions?
We actually made up a spreadsheet for them. It was a great little PDF that had three columns, and it had, you know, like 12 different things on the side, and it compared what you got for each one in each of those
great
things.
Idea.
So it was easy to explain, and I'll highlight some of them. And some were unique to us. One of the things that we did, we prepared for only our retained searches. We prepared a position prospectus. And it was something that our marketing department put together with my help and the client's help. And it was, they could either have it in hard copy or electronically, whichever, or both. And it was probably about a 25 or 30 page document that covered an introductory letter from me about why this was an exciting search, the history of the company, a good amount of information about the position itself, bios of the principals of everybody in the company that were involved in the search, an org chart of where the positions fell in the company, a good bit of background technical information that my people would want to know about what that specific plant had to offer. And then about 8 or 10 pages at the end about geographic location, because for us, 98% of our placements involved relocation, potentially from one side of the country to another. And they don't put refineries in beautiful locations that everybody wants to live. So most of the time you have to explain what the upside is of any location, or the silk purse to the sow's ear, if you will. And so there was a big section on geography and what the area was like, what the attractions were like, what the family opportunities were, what the schooling was like, what the taxation was like, what the housing was like. Anyway, by the time we got finished, this was like a 28-page thing. And it was such a wow factor for our clients. We worked with many companies that didn't have big, glossy Fortune 100 corporate brochures, and we became their corporate brochure.
Right.
The traction that we got, I mean, all you had to do was send a new client a sample of an opportunity position prospectus that we put together for another client. And they were like, wow, we want one of those. And I said, great, then you have to be retained. We do this free of charge for all of our retained searches. And of course, you know, there's economies of scale, because at that point, you know, if you do one retained search for a client at a specific location, it's easy for them to then give you three searches at the same location and still do them retained, because then it's easy to replicate that brochure for that same location. And they're all over that. So that was a really big thing for us. That was a big sell factor. For our engaged searches, we told them that we would, under certain circumstances, prepare a brochure for them, but they had to pay for it. It was not available on a contingency search. So that was one of the big differentiators. Another big differentiator for us was our guarantee period. We gave a 1-year replacement guarantee on all of our retained searches, 6 months on engaged, and 90 days on contingency. So those were just a couple of the big examples of some real significant differences among the three searches. But we literally put together a PDF that we could send to them and say, look, you know, share this with your team, share this with your HR department. You decide which value prop makes the most sense for you.
So that's a great takeaway for listeners right away, is thinking, I can visualize that, right? The three columns of what's included and what the benefits are in each of these types of service. And you have a number of, you're building more value, obviously, in the retained column than in the contingent column. You're still going to do a good job in the contingent column, right? But it's a different product, essentially. And it doesn't have all the bells and whistles. And the brochure stroke opportunity prospectus, I think, or position prospectus, I think you called it, is a fantastic idea. I don't know why more recruiters don't do that, because if you think of it, like if you hire a realtor to sell your house, they're going to take photographs and they're going to do a brochure, right? And because people want to be able to visually, like if they're going to picture themselves living in that home, they need to be able to visualize it, and it has to be appealing to them. In the same way, you need someone to visualize working for that company, What would the benefits be? Could I see myself in that location? And so it's, yeah, that's a genius idea, Carol.
One of the things also, excuse me, I'm sorry, Mark, because we have so much spousal relocation, when you have something like that and you can, the family can actually sit down together and say, okay, look what this client has put together. First of all, it's a wow factor for the client. And the family looks at it and says, gee, no other companies are sending us this. Look what this company is willing to do to attract us. So that's one thing. But the spouse sits down and they can get involved right away in schools and housing and taxation and family recreation. And, you know, spouse buy-in can make or break a deal, especially, you know, at the higher levels.
Okay. This is a really key takeaway, Carol, which is, on both sides, the client side and the candidate side, you're probably going to have one main point of contact, but there's other influencers that you may or may not have any communication with. So what ammunition can you give to your decision maker to make it easier for them to sell internally? So you mentioned to the spouse, we can't rely on the candidate being able to articulate what's great about this company, why it's a great career move, and also why it would be a nice location, right? Because especially, I mean, maybe if you play salespeople or people who are very commercial, they might be able to do that. Right. But the reality is most candidates, you could give them the most beautiful pitch and explanation, but then by the time that gets translated to their spouse, it's not going to have the same attraction, right? So by giving them that, it makes it easier for them. And then on the client side, that document described, you know, if let's say your hiring authority wants the retained service and their colleagues say, oh no, we only work contingent at that level, right? Mm-hmm. They might say, well, I understand that, but take a look at this. And then is again, it's easier for them to get that buy-in and for people to go, oh, okay, well, yeah, actually, now that I've seen what's included, I agree, we should get the retained level. So,
and you know, the other thing that another place I think it has a lot of impact, many of my clients, as I'm sure many of your listeners have had this issue, have insulated their hiring managers, and they have gone to more sophisticated HR type of systems.
Yes.
And I learned over time that it is much better to co-opt HR into the process than try to alienate HR from the process. Mm. And when you put together this position prospectus, we work specifically with HR and we tell our hiring manager, please put us in touch with your HR group, because we need their help in putting this together. And so it automatically becomes the entire company's team effort. And HR feels included and they feel like they were a developmental part of the process. And they're on board like from day one, and you become the partner from day one. And it's not an adversarial me versus HR kind of thing, which is, I think, critically important right now.
Got it. Absolutely. We might, if we have time, we'll talk more about that. But yes, and use the word partner there, which is an important distinction between being a supplier or being a partner. Let me ask you this, Carol, because when I teach people to win retained searches, then I have, look, I've learned in recruiting, there's not one right way of doing things, but I tend not to go over the various different options. I tend to say, here is based on our understanding of your needs and having taken a full brief, here is the solution that is, you know, most likely to get you that outcome. And so we recommend a retained, you know, solution. Here's how it works and here's what you get, kind of thing. Uh-huh. Because part of me feels that if you give them options, some people are going to default to what is the most familiar. Does that make sense? Or
I
mean, obviously that, yeah. But so when you're presenting these options, how do you do it in such a way that, because you know that in most cases, we want the retained option, mm-hmm. right? So when you're presenting it, how do you do it in such a way that that's the direction that you're recommending?
A lot of it has to do with how badly I want to work the position.
Okay.
And or how badly I think my team should work the position versus me personally. If I'm pitching it and it's a high level position, or it's a low level position and it's going to be really hard to fill. I mean, all of the things that in my mind tick the boxes for why I could justify retain. I will go in after listening to everything that they tell me about the search. I will recommend to them that a retained option is the way to go. And then I will explain why I think retained is the best option under those circumstances. Yeah. And I will then explain to them what they get for the retained money. Yeah. And if I sense hesitancy, then we start a conversation about which part of this difficulty to fill thing do you disagree with? Because
right.
really, it's the difficulty to fill that ultimately I think is going to define whether they go to retained or engaged. I mean, if any of their in-house recruiters can go on LinkedIn and pull 12 candidates, they are not
sure.
going to do a retained search. And I don't want to pitch retained search for something like that. I want to pitch retained search for something that has, where they want exclusivity, that time, that has urgency, and that has difficulty to fill. Those three things.
Yeah.
Or some combination of those three things.
Right.
Because if it doesn't have those three things, I'm not that excited about the search. And I learned a long time ago that I don't have to work everything. I
sure.
will work the things that I'm excited about because I'm going to do the best job about the things that I'm excited about or that prove a challenge to me or whatever. So, you know, first we discuss urgency. You know, how urgent is it to fill the search? And then we talk about how difficult is it going to be to find the person they want and move them to podunk in the middle of nowhere, USA.
right.
And then we talk about what else have you tried to do to fill the search and how have your efforts gone with that, which leads to the urgency piece. And then when they've checked all three of those boxes, they're like, oh yeah, retain makes sense in this case.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't go there. And I will say, fine, look, you know, you can have a half a step down from this, you know, the stepchild, if you will, and we can look at an engaged. Here's what you're trading off. You won't get quite as much urgency and response. And you're not going to get quite as much exclusivity because we're not necessarily going to push candidates to your search first. But you will get something much better than contingency, which I think is what you need. Now, when they hear what they're not getting, they don't like that, right?
Yes.
And so they tend to default back. And then I say to them, well, before you make the decision, let me send you a sample of a position prospectus.
Right.
Because this comes standard with our retained search. And if you agree that this is going to be a tremendous value add because this search is going to be difficult, then I think you'll see that retained is the right option. And 90% of the time, if I can't win it on the initial call, when I go to the follow-up call after they've seen the position prospectus, they almost always revert to a retained.
Brilliant, Carol. I love that. That's really, you're giving us a masterclass here. So thank you for that. That's really good.
You know, I will share with you, Mark, and this is my vulnerable side. Before I started moving into retained search, the owner of our firm, Bruce Whitaker, for years beat me over the head with, Carol, why are you spending all of your time doing contingency? You really should be a retained recruiter. And I had this serious, I'm not worthy issue that retained was up here and I didn't see myself here, right? And And that's an inner perception that I think many of us struggle with, especially people who want to go from contingency to retain. It's like, why all of a sudden am I good enough to do retain? And so what solved that problem for me was understanding not what was changing in me, but what was changing in the service that I was providing. You know, how did I justify the difference between what I was doing in contingency versus what I was doing in retain? And it dawned on me that I was providing retained search at a contingency price.
Aha, yes, and I was absolutely.
Like, you have to stop doing this, Carol.
Right.
And that's when the aha moment hit. That's when the light bulb went on. And I was like, no, people really will pay more for what you're doing on contingency. And so stop doing all of that on contingency. And that was the aha moment for me.
That's brilliant. I love that you shared that. And so the aha light bulb moment, I think absolutely, you know you're ready to make that shift if you find that, or you feel like you're already delivering a retained quality of service, but you're just not getting paid for it, then why are you doing that, right? Let's draw a distinction between if you want this level, then this is what it takes. Did you have a different fee percentage for those different tiers, or?
We did not.
Yeah, I didn't either. And I think, now I have seen some, I've seen it work three ways. And I'd like your take on this. So the way I did it was the fee percentage is the same. The only difference is the way the payment is structured, but you're getting all this more value. So why wouldn't you do that, right? You're getting more value.
That's exactly what we said. We said, look, the price is the same. You're going to end up paying the exact same amount no matter which option you choose. The only difference is your cash flow.
Right.
So if it makes sense to you from a cash flow, why wouldn't you do all these other things if it's going to cost the exact same thing anyway?
Right, right. Now, I have seen some firms where it's a higher fee percentage for the retained, and I don't quite get why you would, because that seems like you're making it more difficult for yourself to sell it. And to me, of course, we want to maximize our fee percentage, but I would trade off almost guaranteed fee, slightly few percent less for a higher percent where I've got a 25 or 35% chance of actually getting paid.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one of my mentors early on in my career said, I don't mind giving something up if what I'm getting in return is more than the value of what I'm giving up.
Right. Absolutely.
And I always
now, I have seen an interesting model, which some... In fact, I saw Rich Rosen, our mutual friend Rich, does it this way, as he actually decreases the fee based on the commitment. So if it's contingent where it's a bun fight and he's like, you know, he could do everything right and still not get paid, that's whatever it is. I don't know what it is. Let's say 30%. If it's engaged so that they have skin in the game and he knows they're serious, then it's, you know, 28%. And then if it's retained and they're going all in and it's a true partnership, then it's 25%. I don't remember the percentages, but it's something like that. What do you think of that idea?
I mean, that's fascinating. I would have to process that a little bit more.
Okay.
As with everything in this business, Mark, I truly believe it is an art and not a science, which to me means there is no one right way to do it. You know, in science, it's right or it's wrong. You do it right or it blows up, right? In our profession, there is no such thing. It is more of an art and it has a lot of nuances and a lot of gray areas. And, you know, some people are chocolate and vanilla people. Some are like tutti frutti rocky road. And, you know, I'm kind of a tutti frutti rocky road kind of person. So, you know, I like having a lot of different options. And I mean, Rich's idea is very interesting. I'd have to think about whether some of my clients might. You never know what's going to appeal to a client.
Sure. Absolutely. Okay, cool. So I'd like to circle back. You said a few really interesting things, and then we moved on, and I'd like to go back. So you said there was a shift where you were a full desk recruiter. You were already a Pinnacle Society member, so you obviously must have been still a top performer, but you felt like you weren't getting the income that you could or should, based on your knowledge, your experience, and, you know, being excellent at what you do. And that one of the changes you made was you adopted the Rainmaker model. Could you explain what that is for those who may not know that term?
Sure. And I will say most of the props for this go to some more mutual friends of ours, Jordan Rayboy and Jeremy Sizemore, fellow Pinnacle members, longtime Pinnacle
members. Great guys.
And they both were using Rainmaker models. And so basically what a Rainmaker model is, you have the primary point person, that was me, doing the client-facing side. I brought in the business. I did the high-level client negotiations. I did all the offer negotiations. I was the prime point of contact for the client. So I brought in all of the job orders. Then,
hence the term Rainmaker.
Right. And then in my model, and there's lots of variations to the Rainmaker model, but I was here. And then under me, I had a team of recruiters who did nothing but recruit on my job orders.
Yeah.
And they made the initial presentation calls to the candidate. They pre-qualified the candidate. They qualified on location and all of those things. And then they would run the resumes by me. I would say yay or nay. And then I would let them take it up to the first telephone interview. Now, our steps were telephone interview, sometimes a second telephone interview, and in person, and then the offer negotiation. So after the phone interview, they did the initial telephone interview debrief. And this is my model. Not everybody does the same. And then if it was positive, if we were starting to move to an on-site, I took over the candidate side from there. I prepped for the location because this is another weird thing for me. I have gone to every physical location of every client I've ever worked with.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
Because they are all in weird podunk locations. And my belief is that I can't sell Nowhere USA unless I've been there and put eyes on it myself.
Right.
And I know for a fact that I am the only recruiter in my niche that has been to every location, and my clients know that. And I did that on my dime because it was important to me, or my company's dime. Anyway, so because I have been to the site, I've been to the location, it's much easier for me to do the candidate prep, to go on site, because I can tell them what to expect. But the recruiter still stays in the dialogue because, I mean, I'm training my recruiters to move up to potential rainmakers at some point.
Yes.
And then I do all the offer negotiation. And then the other person that's in my mix in the Rainmaker model is I have a person that I call a production assistant. It's not a researcher. It is a blend of a researcher and admin person. And we could spend another 30 minutes talking about this position. But basically, what I came to realize is that if you put an hourly value on what you do in the day, you know that there are certain things that just aren't time efficient for you to do. But it requires somebody who has a fairly intimate knowledge of what goes on your desk and the candidates and clients. And that's the role that my production assistant plays. I give my production assistant access to my candidates and clients, but they do the, do you want to see Joe at 2 or at 5? Do you want to see Joe on Monday or Friday? Carol wants to know if you got the resume and if you've had a chance to look at it yet. Those kinds of things. She would do it by email. She would do it by phone. She was like a little mini me.
Great.
And I compensated her with a base salary and a spiff off of my gross. And so she got an over a percentage of every placement that I brought in. She got a percentage. So, and her goal was to take more off my plate to allow me to do more of the true rainmaker things to bring in more placements.
You're the second. Catherine Gerald used the term spiff. I was like, what the heck is a spiff?
Yeah.
I've never heard of this before. What does that mean? Is that an acronym? What does that mean?
No, I think it's a generational thing. It came actually from the generation before me, which means it's truly ancient. But it just means something that comes to you without you really truly having to earn it.
So it's like it's a bonus, freebie. Basically.
Yeah, it's a bonus. Okay. It's a freebie.
Okay. And are you comfortable sharing, like, what percentage would that role of production assistant merit?
When I started, and I went through several production assistants over time. Yeah. Some wanted to graduate to being recruiters. Some did not. But I always started them at 3%. And that was for 60 to 90 days, depending on how confident I felt about what I thought their trial period should be. And then I increased them to 5%. And when I felt like they were hitting it on a regular basis and they were really, truly adding value, I gave them 10%.
Great. Now, this gets the complicated part of the Rainmaker model is allocating credit to the different parties that are involved in closing that placement. And so, first of all, let me just share. I like, and it obviously works really well for you. I like the Rainmaker model because most of us, well, I speaking for myself, there are certain things I'm better at than others, right? And certain things I enjoy more than others. So if I have to do everything, then it means that I'm not unlocking my full potential. Whereas if I could concentrate, I think I'm a lot like you. I preferred business development, client development, that kind of stuff. I did not prefer sourcing and recruiting candidates. This model wasn't one I was aware of. And so I was doing a full desk. And I think that definitely limited, I don't want to make excuses, like, you know, but I do wonder sometimes how much more I could have built if I was just in my core strength of you know, winning new clients and bringing them on board.
I will tell you in real numbers that the year I went from 360 desk to Rainmaker, my production increased 70% in 1 year.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So,
And I was already at pinnacle level billing.
Exactly. Exactly. That's fantastic, Carol. So you have involved in every placement. You've got, obviously, you, who's the quarterback. You've then got your production assistant. You've got a recruiter who's sourced and done the first level of qualification with a candidate. Is there anyone else who might have touched that process, or is it really just the three?
No, I mean, we had an admin person, but I mean, she is an employee of the company, and she is an entire department admin.
Yes.
So she could potentially support several Rainmakers.
Yes.
Not just.
Okay, makes sense. So then how do you split the commission between, obviously you've said it's 3%, then 5%, then ultimately 10% to the production assistant. Then what about the recruiter in that scenario?
So all of our deals were 50-50. 50 to me, 50 to the recruiter. And the production assistant, her 10% came off of me.
Oh, interesting. So that wasn't 10% off the top. It was 10% of your 50%.
And
okay.
Yeah. It came off of mine because she was driving my production. She was doing stuff for me personally.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. Now, here's where it gets potentially more complicated. If, let's say, you then develop...
Go ahead. Excuse me, Mark. So that's how we started. How we evolved, because I was not a solo entrepreneur. I was working for a firm. And so I still had a split with the firm.
Right.
So as my production went up, obviously the company, the firm split is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And so what I agreed to with the owner of my firm, and it was his offer, which was very generous, was that when the number reached a certain number, that 10% came off of his split.
Oh, excellent. That's cool. That's exactly where I was going here, Carol, is that a lot of our listeners are owners. And so we need to find a split that's fair to all everybody. So there's the firm, there's the rainmaker or account executive or practice leader or whatever their job title is, the client person. Then there's the recruiter, and potentially there's a sourcer or researcher or production assistant or whatever. How would you see it working in that sort of scenario? Like, and that could even happen in your scenario where you've got a recruiter who then starts developing their own client relationships and becomes their own practice within your department.
Then they become their own rainmaker, and right. you know you replicate pods, right?
Yeah.
So mine was a pod, if you will,
yeah.
And if somebody develops into a rainmaker, and I have had this in my team where one of my recruiters really ultimately wanted to become a marketer and drive business development. And, you know, she realized that that's where the big money was. And that was great. And so we broke her off into her own pod, and she had a group of recruiters working for her. She didn't grow, at least during the time I was working with her, did not grow to the point of having a production assistant working for
her.
Got
it.
Okay. But she was a rainmaker with recruiters working for her.
Got it. And at what point does it make sense to bring on a production assistant?
I think that's going to be up to the owner. For us, our rule of thumb was when your billings hit 300,000.
Okay.
You're dealing with enough volume that you got to have another person help you. There's just too much going on your desk.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic.
But, you know, for different firms, it's really dictated by the nut of your company. For some firms, that could be a lower number. Some firms, it could be a higher. In our firm, it was 300.
Okay. Fantastic. I'd like to switch gears a little bit because since we're on the topic of business development and, you know, you're now, you have trained recruiters at all levels for a long time. And now, in this chapter of your life, that's actually what you're focusing on.
Right.
What I'm hearing in the market is that not all, but I'd say the majority of recruiters right now, we're in a season that everyone is looking for more clients. So if you're running a workshop on business development for a recruitment company today, what are the most important, strategy, technique, or tactic that they need to practice?
I would say the number one thing for me is really look at what your specialty niche is. There is a term that a couple of big recruiter trainers use called market mastery. I'm sure you've heard that term.
Yeah.
Sure. And I believe that's true. If you cannot become a market master and dominate your niche, then your niche is too big. And,
got it.
And
yes.
I tell frequently a story that I heard when I was very early in my career. It was at a top producer panel in Texas about the top producer of the year was being interviewed. And somebody asked how he could double his billings from one year to the next. And he said, my boss came to me and told me he was cutting my client base in half. And I said, oh my God, what's that going to do? And he said, you're going to double your billings. And he said, I didn't believe him. And he went on to explain this idea of market mastery and market mastering your niche. And that was, again, you know, we talk about aha moments in your career.
Yeah.
That was an aha moment in my career. And I always said to people, I want a niche where it's not 7 degrees of separation, it's 3 degrees of separation. Like, if you don't know me, go to the person in the office on either side of you and one of them knows me.
Right.
I mean, I want my name on the bathroom wall of every refinery in the United States. that was my goal. And so I would say, you know, for somebody who's really focused on being a big biller and looking at business development, the first thing you got to do is look at your niche. And decide, is my niche too big? Is my niche too small? Can I dominate the niche that I'm in? And yes. And then once you define that, and you have to give yourself some fluff here, because I was painfully aware the oil industry has a lot of peaks and troughs. And when you're at a peak, it's great. You don't need more clients. But when you're in a trough and you're specialized in a niche, you're like, okay, now what do I do, right? What am I going to eat off of? So your niche has to be small enough that you can dominate it, but you have to have some like tangential places that you can play that sort of dovetail with your niche, so that mm-hmm. when you're in a downtime, you can kind of flop over. So for me, that meant looking at consulting companies that consulted into my niche. They were using the same kind of people, so I didn't have to get out of my niche. But they weren't people that I marketed to on a regular basis. When business was great, I didn't do as much work with the. So that's what I'm saying about having tangential places when you evaluate your niche. And that's where I start with everybody who's looking at business development. Test your niche.
That is a great distinction. I like the idea of having tangential or adjacent niches that aren't completely different. They're interrelated to your core niche as well. So it's counterintuitive, right? Because a lot of people assume I'm going to lose out on opportunities if I narrow my focus. But the reality is the opposite, right? By narrowing your focus, you're actually going to make more money, not less. So I think once people get their head around that, then it starts to make sense. One of the ways I explained it is like, if you're, and the argument people say, well, I'm a great recruiter, I can recruit anybody, right? But that's like saying, if you're running a restaurant that you serve any type of food, right? And so someone comes in and you serve steak to one customer, and then sushi to another customer, and then an Indian banquet to a third customer, that would be crazy, right? Right. You can't operate a restaurant that way. So once someone has settled on their niche, then what's your what's the kind of game plan, the business development game plan from there?
It has to do with relationship building for me, Mark. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a truism that people work with people they like. It's not always the cheapest person. It's not even always the best service. You know, it's right. The people they like. And so you have to make it a point to do what you need to do to develop that kind of personal relationship. And that doesn't happen in a week or a month or even a year. You know, I tell people that it's true that I had an unfair advantage. I mean, I was 20 years, 25 years in the same niche. You know, I tell people that I laugh, I outlived some of my competition. I mean, a couple of people died. But I mean, you know, so short of that. But it is true that people have to start associating your name with your niche.
Okay.
In order to do that, you have to keep being out there, keeping your name in front of them, staying in touch with your hiring managers when they're not hiring. That is so important. We started a monthly newsletter. Again, subject for another call. But we started a monthly newsletter so that we would stay in touch with our hiring managers, whether they were hiring or not, every month.
Yeah.
Everybody in our database got it. I would send things of value that I thought were of common interest, whether people were hiring or not. You know, we all in our conversations find out, you know, where they went to school, what their kid does, what sports their kids play. Anything that allows you to develop a relationship and be there when they're not hiring. And I think this is the mistake that way too many people make. We become a bit transactional.
Yeah.
You know, we're there when you need us, and then we disappear when you don't need us.
Right.
And I think it is way, way, way more important to be there when they don't need you.
Uh-huh.
Because then when they need you, it's second nature to call you, because you're the person that's always in touch.
You're the first person that they would think of in relation to your particular niche. So that all makes complete logical sense. The question is how, like, what does that look like on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis? You mentioned, obviously, the monthly newsletter is one thing, but how else are you keeping in consistent touch and building those relationships with your hiring managers?
So, you know, at the risk of sounding very old school, I had A clients, B clients, and C clients, right? Okay. And my A clients were my retained clients that were hiring right now, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, I talk to those people almost daily, right?
Sure.
And then my B clients were people that had hired from me before, but maybe they were not retained. Maybe they had an ongoing search and they were engaged or contingency. Or maybe they had done retained searches with me. They just didn't have anything going on right now. Those were B clients. And then the C clients were not the people you don't want to work with, but the C clients were people that I had made some contact with, but not developed into an actual working relationship with of any kind, contingency or otherwise. And my frequency of talking to those people varied. A clients I talked to like daily. My B clients, I talk to like weekly, and my C clients, I would try to call them once every 4 to 6 weeks, whether I was doing work with them or not. I would make a like live person to person talk to somebody. Hi, how are you doing? Happen to be thinking about you. Very often I use MPC presentations. I MPC all the time. I mean, I think everybody knows what MPC calls are. But going in with a candidate, marketing a candidate, I don't believe in self and service marketing. I believe in candidate marketing because candidates are a hard commodity in our market. And I would call them out of the blue and say, hey, you know, I know we're not working together. I know you don't have anything going on, but, you know, I'm working with this really great guy that I turned up on another search. And I thought of you. I was wondering, you know, he lives in your area. You know, could you use somebody like this? And it's, I don't care if they say yes or no. Makes no difference. Right. It's not the real reason I'm calling them anyway. I just want to stay on their radar. And it is that frequency of, it's the personal touch. You can send all the newsletters in the world. You can send all the articles in the world. But if you don't make that personal touch, if you don't say, hey, I was thinking about you, then they don't think about you either. I mean, you know, it's a two-way street to me.
Right. I love this. This is really cool. So how many calls is that on a daily basis to that combination of A, B, and C clients?
I don't know. I live on the phone. I have no idea. I mean, truly, I did not keep track of my outbound calls. I mean,
I understand you didn't need to keep track, but let's say you're training a new recruiter joining your business. They haven't had 30 years in the business. Right. They're building their niche from scratch. What are you recommending?
I would not put a time on it as much as I would say, if your focus is business development, 2/3 of your day needs to be spent doing business development. And for me, business development means like 25% doing passive business development, like newsletters and all of that. And 75% means making live calls.
Got it.
So I'm not dictating people's time. I'm just saying that at least 75% of your time has to be doing business development. If you're a rainmaker, that's what you need to be doing.
Got it. All right. So if it's, let's say an 8-hour day, 2/3 of their time on business development is 6 hours for the sake of argument, and then 75% of that is 5 hours. So 4 or 5 hours on the phone every day.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
Fantastic. Carol, so you're now in demand as a trainer and speaker with the, is it Tanbank Group?
Tanbark. Mm-hmm.
The Tanbark. The Tanbark Group. So what's your next chapter and how are you leaving a legacy for the recruiting industry?
To me, the best legacy that we can leave anybody out there, I think, is to elevate our profession, elevate the level of our profession. So training one person to make them even a little better is leaving a legacy because it's elevating our entire profession. So some of the training that I do is one-on-one with a specific recruiter that's having an issue. Some of the training that I do is a firm who will bring me in because they sense that their team is struggling with some things and they just need to hear the same thing from an outside voice sometimes. Sometimes it is industry training. I've done a lot. I have a seminar coming up for the Texas Association in the next month or two. I forget exactly. And those are more broader range topics. So to me, all of that is building the legacy. It is helping recruiters, one recruiter at a time, making our entire profession better.
Amazing. And I'm sure you've already had a profound impact on so many recruiters. Carol, that was a lot of fun. Thank you for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark. I mean, yeah, I feel like we only scratched the surface on so many things, but I really enjoyed the time.
Oh, good. Me too. It's been really, really valuable. So many really specific takeaways. So I appreciate that. Have an awesome rest of your day.
Thank you as well, Mark.
Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button and I'll see you next time.